Java Chrome Institute for Advanced Studies. So this is going to give us an introduction to string theory.
Okay. First, as always, as usual, I'd like to thank the organizers for the kind invitation to come here. And this time, I need to thank also for giving me this wonderful opportunity to give this introductory talk on string theory. This is, in fact, my first time to give this type of colloquial or introductory style talk, so please see how well it goes. And I'm not going to give you a very broad introductory talk on string theory. Instead, I chose to speak about three topics which interest me most. And I'd like to, if I will be able to tell you the tell you the joy of doing string theory, I'll be happy. So let me start. So the contents are split into three parts. I will first talk about the relation between string theory and the unification of the forces, and then I move on to the application of string theory to mathematics. And then finally, I will like to talk about the application of string theory. So let me start. And please stop me anytime if you have any questions. So as we all know, the real world consists of matter and forces. The matter part consists of electrons, quarks, blah, blah. They are all fermions, and they are bound and interact using forces, which are gravity, photons, gluons, and W boson and such. And this system, this description of the world was developed for a long time, and now this standard model plus gravity is known to describe the world really, really well. It agrees, the prediction coming from this physical theory predicts the reality extremely well. And it is tested experimentally very, very good to a very, very good accuracy. So let me remind you what are the force fields for. And so the gravity is described mathematically by a metric on a curved manifold. So what you have is a curved coordinate system. This should be four-dimensional in the real world, but I only drew a two-dimensional part. So you have some curved coordinate system. And this physical field, the metric, g mu nu, describes the proper distance between two points separated infinitesimally using this formula. So the proper distance is given by the square of the coordinate distance weighted by this coefficient. And photons and gluons and other force fields are described by the gauge field, a mu. And that works as a comparison agent between the internal space at two points. So not only in the real world, not only there is this coordinate space of the space-time, but also there are internal space, and various quantities, matter fields, takes value in this internal space. And you can choose whatever coordinate system for the internal space for various points. So there needs to be something which allows us to compare these values on the different points. So this gauge field acts as this gauge field allows us to connect the value of these internal spaces by this kind of multiplication. And people have identified what is the gauge group of the real world, and that is U1 gauge group times SU2 times SU3. This U1 part times SU2 part describes unified electroweak force, and this SU3 part gives you the quantum chromodynamics, which governs the strong force. So again, let me stress that standard model plus gravity really works well, really describes the world. So, well, we might be allowed to become a bit arrogant and ask a deep or philosophical question. For example, how did nature choose this particular matter field content? Like, why are there three families of leptons and quarks and such? Oops, you can be more arrogant and ask, why do we have this particular gauge group in the first place? Why do we have gravity and gauge fields in the first place? Well, these gravity or gauge fields are rather sophisticated mathematical concepts. So it is quite strange that the nature needs to choose this sophisticated machinery to describe the world. And it's a very mysterious question. We can even ask, why are there 3+1 dimensions, right? So there are a very deep questions which cannot be answered by thinking them directly because they are so hard. So let me remind you how this standard model is described. So they are described by the fields, and they come from the quantization of particles. So what people have done around World War II or shortly afterwards was to quantize the system of many particles and antiparticles relativistically using quantum theory. And we all know that it was really, really hard. It took a long time to establish it, but well, around 1950, it is, well, mostly done. And people have found later that you can choose almost whatever matter contents. For example, you can put as many quarks as you want without losing consistency, for example, and you can write down whatever Lagrangian you want. And if you want, you can consider, instead of four dimensions, you can consider a five-dimensional world, three-dimensional world, and you can write down a more or less consistent theory. There is a problem about the renormalizability, but if you allow yourself putting, well, infinite number of coefficients, there is no logical inconsistency in it. So this is a very simplified view of the current situation of the quantum field theory as a theory to describe the world. So it standard model describes this world really, really well, but it does not explain why the nature chose a particular Lagrangian. Now, around 1970s, some stupid guys try to quantize strings instead of particles for strange reasons. They did not try to answer deep questions. They just happened to quantize strings. Well, if the quantization of particles resulted in a fluid-fold theory, why don't you quantize strings? Or why don't you quantize membranes or higher dimensional objects, right? So they somehow studied these things, and they found that it was really, really hard. It was even harder than quantize particles, harder to quantize strings than to quantize particles relativistically. But anyway, they found a way to do that consistently, and it was established around 1984, and they found very surprising things which they did not expect. So they found that they cannot choose arbitrarily field content. They found that they cannot choose arbitrarily space-time dimensions. So let me summarize what they found. So they found the consistency of the quantization of the string requires 9+1 dimensions. It's very big. And they notice that it automatically requires supersymmetry, which exchanges bosons and fermions. And they also found that the allowed gauge symmetry is either, well, you don't have gauge field at all, or you have SO32 gauge group, or E8 times E8 gauge group, and that's it. And also, they found that the quantization of relativistic string automatically contains perturbative quantum gravity. So if only we lived in 9+1 dimensional world with supersymmetry with this particular gauge group, I think all of the people in this theoretical physics community would have been very, very totally happy and convinced that the real world is explained by the strings, right? Because it really fixes the matter content just by postulating that everything is made out of strings. But of course, we are not living in 10 dimensions. We don't see supersymmetry at all. So string theory should be totally wrong. But wait a minute. There are many ways to try to rescue the string theory. So there are mainly two approaches to try to construct four-dimensional theory. One way is to compactify the extra 6 dimensions we do not want into a very small space, so that effectively, from the long distance, the space-time looks like our 3+1 dimension. So this is the compactification. Another approach is to use the so-called brains, which is a generalization of our membranes to a higher dimensional space-time. So the string theory automatically contains various solitons of various dimensionality. So for example, you can choose a 3+1 dimensional brains and embed that inside flat space-time. And it is known that on these D brains and or brains, you have gauge fields. So you can try to construct standard model using these approaches. So there are a lot of efforts put into this type of analysis. And now it is known that for the real standard model of particle physics can be imitated to a rather detailed degree. And you can construct this particular standard model gauge group using either compactification or a rather sophisticated set of brains, intersection of brains. And also, you can produce the right amount of chiral fermions, by which I mean the electrons and quarks, and you can find the string theoretic system in which you have, for example, 3 families. But we should admit that there's no definite phenomenological prediction coming from string theory yet. So one might wonder, is string theory wrong? Are all of the efforts totally wasted? Well, there is a very good large chance that it might well be not at all related to the reality. And but you can ask another question, is string theory right? And one thing which is clear is that this is at least a consistent theory of quantum gravity and quantization of string theory, quantization of strings. And we have found the various other applications of string theory. So that's what I want to talk about for the rest of the talk. So we all know that string theory has contributed a lot to various parts of other subfield of physics. For example, it gave a big influence to phenomenology or cosmology. For example, the idea of supersymmetry, which is used by almost, well, more than half of the phenomenologists in the world, it originally came from string theory. It does not the experimental check or confirmation of supersymmetry does not imply that string theory is right, but at least string theory worked as a source of this idea of supersymmetry. Also, the extra dimensions idea, which was originally proposed by Kaluza or Klein, but it was revived after string theory. Also, in cosmology and phenomenology, you hear lots of words about using brain to describe inflation or to explain why gravity is weak in three plus one dimensions, right? So all these ideas came from string theory. The other side of the coin is that many ideas inside theoretical physics community, or at least inside the field theory community, all of the ideas flowed into string theory. For example, around 1980s, there were many activities studying the properties of two-dimensional conformal field theories. And also, there are many nice work which studied non-perturbative properties of four-dimensional quantum field theories, like confinement or duality, various things done by Tohoust and others. And also around in 1980s, there were a very big activity in the studies of supergravity in various dimensions. They studied what kind of supergravity Lagrangian is possible and how can they possibly explain the real world physics. So in 1980s, these three subfields are a totally different thing. They did not talk to each other much, but we now know after 20 years of development of string theory that all these ideas are naturally contained in the one framework of modern string theory. So one thing I would like to emphasize is that string theory is not just a theory which tries to describe one thing, but it automatically contains lots of info in a very natural way. So it's a very, very rich physical theory. Again, string theory has not given a definite prediction to particle physics. Maybe I'm repeating too much, but one thing I can say to you is that string theory has given a definite surprising predictions to mathematics. And they were 100% confirmed by mathematicians for the last 20 years. And I'd like to devote one third of my talk to tell you about this aspect of string theory. Right. So again, string theorists did not try to give a surprising prediction to mathematics. It came as a surprising byproduct to their will to try to imitate four-dimensional world. So, as I said, string theory requires 10 dimensions. So we need to get rid of extra 6 dimensions, which we do not want. So you need to compactify the extra dimensions on a 6-dimensional space. And of course, you have an Einstein equation in 10 dimensions. So if this 3 plus 1 dimensional part is flat, you also need to require that the internal part also solves the Einstein equation, which means that it is Ricci flat. And if you also require that the space is supersymmetric, then these two conditions of the Ricci flatness and the supersymmetry tells you that this space is Calabi-Yau. Now, those string theorists found a very surprising physical property of string theory, which says that type 2A string theory on the Calabi-Yau manifold M is equivalent to a slightly different type of string theory called type 2B on Calabi-Yau manifold W, where M and W are different 6-dimensional manifolds. you don't need to understand what this type 2A means or type 2B means. All you have to remember is that string theory related to physical theories on a totally different six-dimensional manifold. One thing to be emphasized is that given M, the manifold M explicitly, you can construct W in an algorithmic way. And also, if you're given a W, you can construct M. So this is the mirror symmetry in the physical sense. This mirror symmetry in the physical sense implies, as a small application, the following very staggering mathematical statement. The statement is this. So let's count the number of two spheres, S2s, in the original Calabian manifold M. It is known that all of the spheres has area which is integral multiple of something. So I'm calling the area as D, which is integer. And let MD to be the number of the spheres of that area. And let us make a generating function of it, right? So this is P of Q, which encodes all the number of spheres in this Calabian manifold. And what people deduced from string theory is that this particular power series solves an ordinary differential equation, whose form can be easily determined from the geometry of the other manifold W. I should emphasize that this statement is very, very simplified, and it is not the real statement, but you get the flavor. This is the so-called mirror symmetry in the mathematical sense. And as you can see, or you can imagine, counting a sphere embedded in a very complicated six-dimensional space is a very hard thing. I cannot even imagine six-dimensional space in my head, right? So you cannot just look into the geometry and count the spheres one by one. But we, as a theoretical physicist, know how to solve an ODE, right? It's a very easy mathematical object. So this mirror symmetry reduces very, very hard mathematical problem in algebraic geometry into a very, very simple problem of solving an ODE. For the original example of mirror symmetry pairs, so-called quintic and mirror quintic manifolds, using this method, physicists or string theorists calculated every term, every coefficient in this expansion, right? And when they calculated these quantities in the 1990s, the first two coefficients were known to mathematicians. They laboriously calculated various numbers of spheres, but string theorists gave an infinite number of predictions for the number of spheres of area 3 and number of spheres of area 4 and 5 and 6. They gave the prediction, lots of predictions. And it was later proved, first one by one by mathematicians, and then smarter mathematicians showed that you can prove this statement as a whole, right? So this was complete surprise to mathematicians, and this mathematical statement was derived from string theory. Of course, string theory is something very vague because it's physics. It is not completely rigorous, but you can extract a very concrete mathematical statement out of that, and it was later proved mathematically. So here you see an analogy. Usually, physical theory gives prediction which is confirmed by experiments, right? Here, string theorists try to give predictions to experiments But so far they failed. But they gave lots of predictions to mathematics, and it was confirmed.
Why had mathematicians cared about this question before it came up in string theory? And what was the relevance to string theory? Like, was there a physical motivation?
Okay. So for mathematicians, I don't know their motivation, but this problem of counting a number of spheres in a higher dimensional manifold is a very, very traditional one, which has been done from in 19th century by Italian group of mathematicians. So it's a very traditional hard problem. Well, maybe they just want to solve hard problems. On the physical side, this system has a lot of particles, right? So you can scatter them, and you can think of measuring the properties of the scattering amplitude. And this series gives you a series of instanton corrections to the scattering amplitude. So if you plug in some particular number q to these functions, it gives one physical amplitude, which can be measurable if the real world is described by this particular complexification. Yes. That's why they try to determine this thing, but they somehow realize that it gives you a very interesting mathematical fact. Okay, so you see this analogy. And all this development of mirror symmetry occurred before I entered this field. So it was already from time immemorial for me. But there was another thing which happened in front of my eyes after I entered this field. So I'd like to describe another instance of this funny phenomenon of the prediction to mathematics. So I will talk about ADS-CFT from a physical perspective later, but let me just use that ADS-CFT duality in a mathematical way. Again, I will introduce lots of jargons, which I will try to explain later. But ADS-CFT duality says that if you have a Creever gauge theory Q, whose modular space is a six-dimensional cone, so this is a conical metric, right? You have a five-dimensional manifold, and you have a cone. And if this cone is a modular space of this particular gauge theory, then this gauge theory is equivalent to a gravity theory, which is type 2B string, on ADS5 times X5. This is a very physical correspondence, which can be used in other ways, which I will come back later. But it also gave a few mathematical surprises. So let me explain what a Creever is. It's a very complicated type of gauge theory. So you have, which can be depicted in terms of this cute diagram, which is called Creevers. Each node of the diagram stands for one SUN gauge group. So in this case, you have 8 SUN gauge groups, and each arrow connecting to nodes stand for a bifundamental matter field. Bifundamental means that you have n indices here. So if you consider this particular field, you have n index here. You have extra n indices here on this side. And this SUN group acts on this side of the indices. And this SUN group acts on the other set of n indices. So this is a very particular gauge theory. And each of these closed loops correspond to an interaction term of these three particles. So if you have this particle, the other particle, and then these two can combine to become another particle like this. So if you are given this particular Creever diagram, you can write down a Lagrangian over quantum theory in a very explicit way. So this is the Creever. On the other side of the duality, you have a five-dimensional space, X. So here I depicted a very particular typical example called YPQ. YPQ is a five-dimensional thing, which is very hard to imagine, but it can be thought in this way. So you have two S2s. So if you have two S2s combined, this is a four-dimensional space, right? And you have one extra circle direction on it. And this number P and Q specifies how many times this S1 fiber wraps on this side. So it wraps P times on this S2, and it wraps Q times on this S2. So it specifies the topological property of this internal manifold. And there is a very definite algorithmic way to construct this manifold X given a quiver theory Q. So you don't need to understand how it is done, but please understand that given a cute diagram like this, you can get a five-dimensional space whose topological property is known. Now, what is surprising mathematically is this. So on this gravity side, on this space-time side, what you do is to try to solve an Einstein equation on this particular manifold, so which is normalized in a particular way. We all know that solving Einstein equation is really, really hard. But clever guys solved Einstein equations for this particular type of manifold, YPQ. And for example, I didn't copy the horrible form of the metric, but you can integrate the volume over this thing and find, for example, the volume of Y43 is given by this interesting combination of square root of 37 or whatever. So what they did is to solve Einstein equation on this five-dimensional manifold, right? And you get the volume. On this side of the quiver, you do an even weirder procedure. What you do is to associate to each node a real number, Ri, and consider this summation of a contribution from each node and arrows. So all you have to do is to add one from each node and add R associated number minus one cubed for each arrow. And you need to put a certain restriction to the R's on each arrow such that the sum of R's of these R's associated to these three edges of the triangle, that should be two, right? So you need this kind of weird condition. You also put the condition that the sum of R minus one of the arrows associated to one node should sum to zero. So you don't need to remember what is this procedure, but please remember that there is a very definite procedure to construct a strange cubic function. And we are told to maximize this A. Now, if you do this procedure for this particular quiver theory, you get a particular number. And what we find is that this particular number is an inverse of the volume of the Einstein manifold. This is really, really weird, right? So let me summarize this construction. You start from a pair of a quiver gauge theory and a space X. And given a space Q, given a quiver Q, you can construct X at least as a topological manifold. And you can do the same thing in the opposite direction. So if you are given a manifold X as a topological manifold, you can construct the fields theory. Now, what you do, what you are told to do by string theorists is that first you need to solve an Einstein equation on this side, which is horribly hard. But once you do that, you can calculate the volume, right? And also on this side, you can solve, you are told to consider cubic functions associated with it and told to maximize it, right? Now, it just happens that this A is inversely proportional to volume, always. So this statement, for example, can be understood for any person who knows well, at least some of the field, quantum field theory, and also general relativity. You don't need to know string theory at all to understand this extracted statement, right? And this statement is true. Around 2006, mathematicians Yao, who devised the manifold Calabi-Yau, again came into this field and proved this statement. So it is true for really rigorously true mathematically. So again, string theory gave you a very weird mathematical statement, which whose significance is completely mysterious if you do not know ADS-CFT, right? Why on earth this combinatorial procedure of associating cubic functions and maximizing it captures the solution to an Einstein equation? That's totally bizarre, right? So this is one power of string theory, which gives you a lot of.
Always like it here,
right? It can be much more complicated, yes.
But it's always a trivial.
So the condition is the cone over x. So x is five dimensional, but the cone over x needs to be Calabi-Yau. Yeah. But as long as the cone over x is a six dimensional Calabi-Yau manifold, you can always construct field Q, and this statement holds. Yes.
But that didn't have any boundary.
So I will now go ahead to explain what is the ADS-CFT. So, okay, so this is the mathematical influence of two mathematics of string theory. So I used ADS-CFT to extract this particular mathematical statement, but now I would like to tell you another application of ADS-CFT. And I'd like to first explain what is this nice correspond. What is ADS-CFT? So let me start with n meter grains embedded in a flat 10-dimensional spacetime of type 2p string theory. Now there are two jargons suddenly appeared here. So I have D3 grains and also type 2p string theory, but please just think of this 10-dimensional part as a flat 10-dimensional graph. The three brains is a 3+1-dimensional solitonic object like this, on which string can have ends, right? So there are closed strings propagating around the bulk, and you have open strings attached to that brain. And because you need to impose Dirichlet condition on the ends of the strings, it is called originally Dirichlet brains, but people shortened that name to D-brains. On the stack of D3 brains, you have N+4 supersymmetric UN gauge theory. It's again a jargon, so let me try to explain to you what it is. So there is a UN gauge group living on this 3+1 dimensional spacetime, subspacetime of 10 dimensional thing. And there are four types of supercharges which is acting on it. So what you have is that you can act supercharges once to the gauge field to have fermions. And because there are four supercharges, you have four types of fermions. You can again act by the supercharges to get scalars. Now, if you recall that Grassmann variables are anti-commuting, you can, if you successively apply two supersymmetry transformations, they anti-commute. So in the end, there are 4 × 3 / 2 × 1 choices of the application of the supercharges. So you have 6 scalar fields. And people have identified that these 6 scalar fields are the transverse fluctuation of this brain. So because you have 10-dimensional spacetime and you have 4-dimensional subspace, this brain can fluctuate on a six-dimensional direction, right? And again, this is a small mathematical surprise that this space-time dimension of 4, if you add this 4 and the number of scalar 6, you get 10, which is a natural dimension for the string theory. And originally, this 10 was derived in a totally different way. And this number of scalars just comes from this combinatorics, right? So there was, well, so the reason why this holds is rather mysterical if you do not know string theory has this D3 brains. Now, if you have n D3 brains, I said that we need UN gauge theories. But UN gauge theory has n by n matrices everywhere. And you might think that n squared degrees of freedom is too much to describe just n brains. But the fact is, there is a potential in the gauge theory of this form, which is the commutator of two scalars and the square of them. So if you want a very low energy configuration, you need to choose commuting phis so that they are simultaneously diagonalizable. So what you have is that phi 1 gives you the x coordinate of n d brains as the diagonal entries, and phi 2 gives you y coordinate of the n d brains in the diagonal entries, and so on. So let's study the low energy limit of this system. So you can shake string in a very wild way so that you have a very massive field. But if you take the low energy limit, what happens is that you only have this UN gauge theory on the brain and low energy gravitons traveling in the bulk. And as you know, gravity couples to the energy. And if the energy is very low, the gravitons doesn't interact very much. So in the low energy limit, you have this n equals 4 super young mills plus low energy gravitons in the bulk, but they are totally decoupled. In fact, there is another way to take the low energy limit using the back reaction of the D brains. So if you have large number of D3 brains, then it should be very heavy, right? And it curves the spacetime around it. The solution to the 10-dimensional Einstein equation can be obtained easily. So this is the classical Newtonian potential if you have six-dimensional transverse space, right? And you need to somehow nicely nonlinearize that to get this solution. So there are two important features in this solution. So this function h diverges as 1 over r to the fourth close to the brain, and it goes to 1 in the infinity. So what happens is that very close to the brain, GRR component diverges. So the position of the brain becomes infinitely far away if you integrate this. So the proper distance from here to the core of the brain is infinite. Coordinate distance was originally finite, but it becomes infinite, and it is called the throat. And this throat has very small G00 component here. So if the observer is at the asymptotic infinity, you see a very, very big redshift factor around this throat region. So the spacetime is, well, in a rough way, can be thought as composed of this bulk part, where the curvature is not so big, and the throat part, where the curvature is big, and redshift factor is big. And again, I should emphasize that the position of the brain is infinitely far away. So in a sense, it disappears. If you take the low energy limit of this system you have, again, low energy gravitons propagating in the bulk, but also you have rather high energy gravitons trapped in the throat, but made low energy by the redshift factor. So there are two ways to take the low energy limit of this system. One is just to take the low energy limit in this description, and the other way is to consider the gravity solution. And these two sets should describe the same thing, which means that n equals 4 super young males should be equivalent to the gravity trapped in the throat. This is the ADS CFT prescription. And you can get the metric of the throat easily by taking the small r limit. And what you get is this. You have an anti-Dozita space and a constant sized sphere. So this is why it is called the ADS CFT correspondence. Another important thing is that if you follow the calculation carefully, you find that the radius of this internal manifold, S5, is proportional to a positive power of the coupling constant, which means that if you have a large coupling constant, then the curvature is large, which means, sorry, the radius is large, so the curvature is weak, and vice versa. This means that a very difficult large coupling problem in gauge theory side can be translated to a weak curvature, almost semi-classical calculation on the gravity side. And there is a very definite way to relate calculation on one side to the calculation of the other side. So they are not just a story, but it can be really implemented and be calculated. So if you want, for example, if you want to calculate the correlation functions of three gauge invariant operators on the gauge theory, what you do schematically is to couple a bulk field living in this ADS side, to these points, and throw the excitation of this associated fields inside the throat, and you calculated the scattering amplitude of them. So there is a very definite method to relate the correlation functions to the scattering amplitudes in the bulk. And if you would like to calculate the correlator of energy momentum sensor P mu nu, then it is the corresponding bulk field is exactly the metric. You can also think of the finite temperature situation for which you, in the gauge theory side, you know that the procedure to be taken is to compactify the time direction in a Euclidean sense. So on the gravity side, you need to do the same thing, but if you do that, you naturally get a Euclidean black hole. So the correspondence becomes the one between finite temperature gauge theory to the ADS black hole system. So let me finish by saying a very interesting prediction from ADS CFT correspondence. So if you heat up this conformal field theory or SUN gauge theory, you can think of it as a fluid. And you can calculate the viscosity of it and the entropy of it. On the viscosity side, there is a so-called Kubo formula, which relates the viscosity to the energy momentum tensor correlator. And as I just told you, it is calculated by the scattering amplitude of the gravitons. And so what you do is to throw gravity waves inside and measure the reflection of it. So what you basically do is to have a black hole with fixed target and throw gravity wave in. So basically, the scattering amplitude is given by the area of the black hole. On the other hand, the entropy of the system is related to the entropy of the black hole. And if you accept that Bekenstein-Hawking entropy, what you get is, again, proportional to the area. So you find that both entropy and viscosity is proportional to one and the same thing, which means that you get the universal result that the ratio of the viscosity to the entropy is a fixed number, which is 1/4 pi.
You mean by viscosity being proportional to the area? So in what sense, can you explain it a bit more?
Well, it's a what kind of explanation do you?
Far away from the black hole, because viscosity is usually
associated with the horizon.
It's defined only on the horizon, is that what you're saying?
So if you follow the ADS-CFT prescription carefully, what you find is that the viscosity of the boundary gauge theory is thus corresponds to the viscosity of the whole, the horizon.
In the bulk?
No.
Okay, so it's just viscosity on the horizon.
Yeah, so the ADS-CFT correspondence does not say that the viscosity of the boundary is a viscosity of the bulk gravity, but it somehow, the consequence of the duality is that the viscosity of the boundary is the viscosity of the horizon. So this result is very universal. As long as once you assume that there is a gravity dual, and it is, if you assume that this is weakly coupled, perfect. So for example, this holds for any theory I talked about in the section on mathematics. And the corrections to this universal result can be calculated. And this result got quite a lot of attention because this number 1/4 pi is very, very low compared to other liquids. For example, liquid helium has around 10 or something for this number, so this is less than 1, right? And
so the statement is that the viscosity of a plasma in the n equals 4 supersymmetric Reynolds theory is related to its entropy by 1/4 pi.
Yes. Yep. So this number is only comparable to that of the QGP plasma, which was measured recently. So that got quite a lot of attention. OK, so let me summarize. I wanted to emphasize 3 points. String theory has given a lot of ideas to particle physics and cosmology. And string theory has produced various interesting, weird predictions to mathematics, which all of which have been confirmed so far. And finally, string theory has given us ADS-CFT duality, which can be used to study strongly coupled gauge theory. Thank you very much.
More questions?
So if you try to resolve the problem of having too many dimensions by using some brain model, would you have a problem with predictability because the future in the brain would not be predicted by the past in the brain because you'd have interactions from the bulk?
So in order to make a realistic model using brain, you also need to compactify the internal space. Otherwise, there will be no interacting gravity. Right? If you have 10-dimensional spacetime, which is infinite, I guess the 4-dimensional Planck constant will be very small, too small to be.
So is the number 4 for spacetime dimensions always put in by hand, or is there any indication that it might come out from the theory?
Usually, it's put in by hand. There are crazier people in the string theory community who says that you
can hear. Up here.
It's recorded, so
well, crazy. It's a good compliment, right? So there are concepts of landscape and such, right? And there are two camps inside string theory. One camp still believes that some dynamical mechanism selects one vacuum, and the other camp just accepts that there will be lots of consistent solutions or consistent vacuum to the string theory. And I belong to the latter camp. For example, the flat 10-dimensional spacetime seems to be a perfectly well-behaved solution, which cannot be eliminated by dynamical properties. So yeah, I would be really happier if this spacetime is 9 plus 1 dimension.
Even with some special properties, three rings has some special properties.
Yes. But that property is related to the property of the gauge fields as it is, right? The gauge field is super renormalizable below and equal to 3 dimensions. It becomes non-renormalizable above 5 dimensions, above or equal to 5 dimensions. So 3 plus 1 dimension is a very important dimension to have an interacting gauge field. And maybe anthropically, if you like anthropy principle, in order to build our body, you might need gauge theory, which is interacting, which might explain 3 plus 1 dimensions, because gauge theory needs to be renormalizable. But I don't know.
So these extra dimensions would have to be pretty small, otherwise we would have seen them already.
But for the experimental?
These extra dimensions must be
obvious. Yeah, they need to be very small.
But what kind of experimental evidence do we have for Einstein's equations holding on a really, really small scale? You keep saying solving Einstein's equations in these extra dimensions.
It will be corrected by various string corrections once the curvature is small, curvature is big. Yeah. So if you really want to study such complexification, what you really need to do is to solve not the Einstein gravity on the internal space, but you need to really solve string theory in the internal space. That's what they did in the compactification of Calabi-Yau. And you don't find this mirror symmetry if you just study Einstein gravity. Yeah. You need to study the string theory itself to see that compactification on two different manifolds are in fact the same.
Thank you. Okay, more questions? Okay, let's thank Yuji for the performance.
Thank you very much.